UFOs, of course, are a really very charged term because most people regard them as nonsense, confusion, for good reason. Because there's been so many hoaxes, so much nonsense, a lot of deliberate nonsense, a misunderstanding. So it's probably the toughest area to research that I'm aware of. And yet, if you cut through all of that, it takes a lot of work to do that, you end up with a core group of serious events recorded by competent people that are disturbing. And they're disturbing for a couple of reasons. The first thing is that are they real? Some of them are real in the sense that they show up on multiple radars simultaneously. They leave evidence behind, burnt ground, radioactivity, that sort of thing. So they're tangible. They're not hallucinations. Radar sets don't have hallucinations, especially multiple ones. So. On the other hand, they exhibit behavior that defies physical laws. They go faster than the speed of sound without sonic booms. They make right-angle turns that are just impossible to rationalize. And perhaps most mysteriously, they appear and disappear almost on command. And so that they defy any rational explanation. But it's interesting, out of that background, there are some people that suspect that maybe these are alien visitors that are out to help us and that kind of nonsense. However, the two people that really spent their lives researching this with great dedication, J. Allen Hynek, the American, and Jacques Vallée, the Frenchman, both of them wrote prolifically, and they both conclude that they're demonic, that they are deceitful, not beneficial, and that they apparently exhibit some kind of intelligence. There were theories for a while that they were visitors from another galaxy, but that quickly gets dismissed with some careful analysis. I think the current thinking is that somehow they appear to be interdimensional. And that gets into a subject of hyperspaces, which requires some background. But the point is they are real. And there's another aspect to them that makes it difficult to research. And that is they are the subject of military classification. They enjoy more protection from a classification point of view than our most sensitive warheads. And that raises a big question, why? But UFOs are prolific. They have appeared throughout history, strangely enough, apparently. But especially since 1947 on, they've been very frequent and in ways that almost deliberately stir up awareness without answers, questions without answers. And as I, having enjoyed some access to the classified environment, in pursuing some of that, I keep running into a phrase called cognitive dissonance. There may be a deliberate attempt to, on the one hand, not explain, but on the other hand, keep people aware of them. And that in itself has some implications. There may be a close relationship between what we see as UFOs and what occurred in Genesis chapter 6, where fallen angels, these are angels bent on mischief, somehow got themselves involved with human women to create a hybrid and called a Nephilim. But those events is what gave rise to the subsequent mythology about Greek demigods and all of that. These creatures were the cause of the flood of Noah. God chose to erase the blackboard, pick eight people, and get rid of the rest. And the flood, of course, was prompted by the fact that, or I should put it another way, Noah was, his genealogy wasn't impaired by this chicanery of the fallen angels. The word tamim in the Hebrew, it refers to a physical defect. He was free of that. His genealogy was. And so, so we know a lot about that because of the passages both in Genesis 6 and it's confirmed two or three times in the New Testament. What many people overlook, it happened a second time when God communicated to Abraham that his descendants, after 400 years, would come back to this land. That gave Satan the opportunity at 400 years to lay down a minefield, and the same kind of activity occurred again a second time. And the Genesis 6 record even makes mention of that. In Genesis 6 verse 4, it says it was also after that. Now, it makes allusion to a second occurrence. And Joshua was instructed to wipe out every man, woman, and child of four key tribes. And that gives rise to the Anakim, and there's there you read. It's amazing. Many people don't really understand the Old Testament because they don't understand what really happened in Genesis 6. It's important. It all ties together. Now, the reason that's so relevant to our discussion here is that Jesus made that strange remark that as the days of Noah were, so shall the days of the coming of the Son of Man be. So in order to understand what he meant, we have to understand what really happened back there. And it's from that allusion that we infer that the UFO thing may be an echo of some, in some sense, of what went on in Genesis 6. So it's not an obvious link, and yet those two subjects tend to get commingled pretty quickly. The hybrids in the of ancient times that are alluded to there, and the UFO experience today, especially since the whole UFO mystery is complicated by the fact of these reports of abductions. There are thousands of reports that are too bizarre to accept, yet too consistent to ignore. John Mack's books, is perhaps one of the most reliable sources to poke into that area. But the abduction thing appears to have a preoccupation with the human reproduction. They seem to be trying to gather information about the human reproductive cycle. And it's as if there's something they're looking for they don't have, because it's, these abductions seem to be data gathering expeditions. And it always seems to have to do with the human reproduction process. The conjecture by some, the offspring, the hybrids, the Nephilim of the past were giants. The word gigantes in the Greek really refers to earthborn, but they're also translated giants. And they were. They're apparently very tall, very substantial. The Hagibarim, the mighty men of old. Apparently, what they're getting today, if that's what they're trying to do, are these 3 foot high. You always see them. There's three different types that show up in the reports, but the diminutive ones seem to be a concern. So one of the conjectures by observers is that it would appear that they're trying to figure out why they're not getting what they used to get. If that's the case, one conjectures that the human genome may have degenerated. There used to be 1,000-year lifetimes back then. Today it's nominally 70, give or take, right? And so that may be somehow involved in this. But those are a mix of conjectures on top of the peculiar reports that we see. Because the days of Noah were clearly hybrids that were generated by fallen angels. And some people have a problem with that because angels don't marry. Those are angels in heaven don't marry. And we know that angels were always masculine, and as exemplified by Genesis 19 in Sodom and Gomorrah and so forth. So I would not presume any limitation on the technologies available to a fallen angel who's bent on mischief. And that's how they went about it. I don't know. There's all kinds of conjectures. Who cares? But they apparently found a way to create hybrids. Now, there is a hypothesis behind all this that might be relevant here. We know from Revelation 12, and when Satan fell, a third of the angels fell with him, which means he's intrinsically facing a 2-to-1 disadvantage. And angels don't multiply. That's a unique property of the human situation. For the fallen angels, bent on mischief for their leader, finding a way to somehow use the human genome as a way of procreating a hybrid that could give them an advantage, not only because they get hybrids around on the mischief that they can accomplish, but let's talk about Noah's flood. When Noah's flood takes place, the hybrids drown. Their bodies drown. But is there a disembodied spirit that remains? Okay. There's a passage in Isaiah 26:14, I think, where the Rephaim cannot rise. In other words, the those that are of that derivation are not eligible for resurrection. Okay. So there are disembodied spirits involved in the death of a hybrid. What happens to that disembodied spirit? It's a conjecture, but we notice when you study the New Testament, that's where the demons show up so prolifically, that there's a difference between angels and demons. I'm assuming fallen angels have the same characteristics of regular angels, which are what? They can take people by the hand. They indulge in combat. One angel slaughters 185,000 Syrians after dinner one night. You don't mess with angels, okay? Now, fallen angels, obviously, then are also formidable. Maybe subject to some restrictions we don't know about, but whatever. But when we encounter demons in the New Testament, they're strange because they seem to be powerless except to the extent they can indwell somebody. And to indwell somebody apparently requires their permission. In fact, they can even indwell pigs with permission. There's that strange event in Gadara where they're confronting this single guy and he is demon-possessed. Jesus has him identify, well, we are legion. They recognize who Jesus is. He hadn't been announced yet. This is early in the scheme of things. They recognize his deity. They're subject to his authority. They also know their destiny. Have you come to torment us before the time? We will learn a lot from that engagement. Then they ask him, they plead with him not to cast them into that herd of swine. Now, that's a strange request, but what's even stranger, Jesus gives them that permission. Why did he do that? I have a conjecture. He did it to show us that that wasn't a psychiatric disorder of the guy. These creatures were real. How many were there? It turns out Mark gives us that number. There were 2,000 of them in this guy. I mean, we clearly can't relate to that somehow. But they enter the swine, and then the swine themselves go off the cliff and they drown. So they still end up dying. So why did Jesus give them the permission to enter the swine? My presumption is to demonstrate to his disciples who are watching that these things are real, they're dangerous, etc. But it's interesting, they could only do what they were granted permission to do. And I believe they can indwell a person only if they have his permission, tacit rather than explicit. That, when you study William Blatty's novel, The Exorcist, I was with Walter Martin. I was on his board in those days. He set out to discredit him. He was shocked because William Blatty had done his homework. His novel on The Exorcist was taken from several case studies, the primary one being a boy in New Jersey. He made it it's a girl in the story. He obviously took an author's liberties there. But the point is, it was based on real case studies. And in that case, it was a gal playing around with a Ouija board that started this whole nightmare that made up the novel. Walter didn't like the way the novel ended because he has Satan win, sort of. But he had to yield because he realized Blatty, he couldn't attack him directly because he'd done his homework. And I remember that so vividly about that. That's, I learned a lot from Walter on those issues. I think there's a big distinction between the fallen angel and the demons, and very few books on demonology point that out. And yet I think I can build that from the biblical text. So that's the place where I have a view that's perhaps different than Merrill Unger and some others who are well noteworthy published in this area, but they don't make the discriminations that I think are in the text. I may be wrong, we'll see. But I think there's a difference between the demons of the New Testament and fallen angels. In either case, though, getting back to your question now, is the UFO thing. I believe the UFOs are demonic for a lot of different reasons. Now, exactly what that means, I'm not sure. Are those things really fabricated, built? If so, where? I have no idea. I think that there's a very dangerous risk in having a substantial command of a particular technology. I have a PhD, I have several graduate degrees, I don't regard myself as an expert, but having traveled in that world, I've been in the government laboratories, the highly classified ones, I was on a board with Dr. Edward Teller. There's a guy that personally changed the course of the world three times. It was he and Leo Szilard that drove out to see Einstein that caused the Manhattan Project to get started. Dr. Teller was the one that was instrumental in the thermonuclear capability. And it was Dr. Teller that talked Ronald Reagan into the Star Wars stuff. And I'm not picking on him. Don't misunderstand my following, Mark, because he was the Renaissance man. He could talk about almost any subject, not just physics. It was 13 months of been precious during the time we both were on a particular board with some other notable people. It was fun. But having trafficked with those kinds of people, I became very aware of the fact that there's a danger in being in expertise. Because as one really gets command of an area, you start to become deaf to contrary winds around that discipline. Well, you'll notice this with doctors. Doctors will tend to interpret their diagnosis in terms of their specialty. That's one reason if you want a generalist, you go to an internist, not a surgeon. In other words, that people, they're very, very much influenced by their area that they become extremely competent in. In the scientific world, that more often than not is accompanied by a lack of humility. You can almost call it, in some people, in some cases, arrogance. There's an unwillingness to entertain ideas unless they're properly qualified. They won't listen to another PhD unless he comes to an equivalently good school. There are a lot of physicists that won't listen to Barry Setterfield because he never quite finished his PhD in Australia for some family reasons. He's brilliant. He's done landmark work. Along with the expertise comes some prejudices. My trademark, personal trademark verse, has always been Acts 17:11. To be like the Bereans, in that they receive the word with all readiness of mind and search the scriptures daily to prove whether those things be so. And for almost 40 years, I've always emphasized that part, the second part. To search the scriptures daily to prove whether those things be so. That's been my watchword in my ministry alone. In the recent years, I've discovered that's not as big a problem as the first part. They receive the word with all readiness of mind. We're entering into topics, whether you're talking about UFOs or you're talking about the harpazo, the rapture. You're entering these areas. You discover one of the critical things in approaching that topic is to be able to set aside your prejudices and go at it with. It's very difficult to go at some of these charged areas with an open mind. I did a book on alien encounters. It was on the radio, so I was being interviewed. I made the remark that it was my view that a Christian can't be abducted. Well, I got a phone call from a Hollywood producer by the name of Tracy Torme. I don't know if he was related to Mel Torme, but I was so startled to get a call from a Hollywood producer. But he says, Chuck, I heard you on the radio, and I happened to be involved in a project. I found out later that it was the movie of the Travis Walton affair called Fire in the Sky, because I saw he was the producer. Anyway, but he said, I know something about what you're talking about there, and I agreed with you up until the point where you said a Christian can't be abducted. You need to check out the Betty Andreessen affair. Well, I was familiar with that, but I'm just listening, taking notes, sort of startled by the call. Well, I doubled back on the Betty Andreessen affidavit, and that was a spirit-filled Christian, 20 years, that apparently had woke up night with some creatures by her bed. They invited her, and she accepted the invitation. See, I don't mean to hang on technicalities here, but I would argue that that's not an abduction. And she had some unpleasant experiences and recorded, and it's in the folklore of the UFO reports, as is the Travis Walton story also. And so I still stand my ground. I don't believe a Christian can be abducted, because I think we have authority of those things. I think they'll try to. My little counsel in the book was, don't let them bluff you. You have authority in Christ, and don't accept any invitations. And I really admonish what I call spiritual hygiene. Don't allow yourself to get hypnotized. Don't permit yourself to entertain what are called entries. Don't play the Dungeon and Dragon games. Don't recognize there's a danger in these video role-playing games. These are all they're not certainly evil of themselves, but they can be used as entries on those that would choose to get across. Your volition is in control, but they're trying to get over that. The fact that they're hostile, the fact that their goal seems to be our destruction, is disturbing. And another aspect that's disturbing, people that have had an encounter seem to have them more than once. They seem to return back. People that had an experience as a child have it later. Had an interesting dialogue with Hal Lindsey and Walter Martin. We were talking about these issues because Walter Martin was very aggressive on the idea that a Christian can't be possessed, and from the scripture. And Hal had a number of experiences in ministry that would seem to go the other way. And so they were friendly, just exploring that with a difference of view. But in comparing notes and exploring that, they came to an interesting conclusion. In every case that Hal brought up, that would seem as if a Christian had a serious harassment of some kind, they always had an occultic involvement earlier. And one of the conclusions they came together, I was with them when this all, that's why I was fascinated with the discussion. One of the things they highlighted in, among themselves, the old days, the classical denominations, when you accepted Christ, they had a procedure which involved the denouncing of Satan, all his works and all his ways, an explicit denunciation of him. The Catholics still do that, and I think the Lutherans do, but it isn't our normal style today. They come down the Sawdust Trail and you know, go through the typical routine that we use today. There isn't, it doesn't necessarily include an explicit renunciation of the past in terms of it's one thing to repent of your sins. It's quite another. There are aspects to our past we may not know, but to renounce it, to renounce any hold that might be there, apparently may be good hygiene, because that may be part of what's causing confusion. If one wants to stand back and look more conspiratorial, one could argue, I would put the conspiracy in the hands of Satan, not necessarily some group in a room kind of thing. But that gets back to the whole cognitive dissonance argument also, the fact that we seem to be prepared for a surprise coming. They're groping for an alternative justification for their worldview that doesn't show an accountability to God. Now, what they overlook is that even panspermia just postpones the accountability, doesn't get rid of it. But the whole idea of mankind being accountable to a creator is something that they're trying to distance themselves from. It's the same thing the psychologist does as he deals with guilt. He can only deal with a symptom, not the real cause, which is sin. They have no way to deal with sin, but they recognize that guilt is a major, major factor in human behavior and how to deal with it, but they deal with it in dealing with the symptom, not the cause. Well, in terms of life in outer space, it's the same kind of thing. It's a quest to broaden the debate outside any local accountability. But there may be something more engineered than that. I have a peculiar eschatological view that may impact here, so let me just throw this in if it makes sense. I'm fascinated as I study eschatology that almost everything there falls into a structure, except one thing. There's one thing God generally tells us what he's doing, Amos 3:7, other verses. But there's one thing that seems deliberately indefinite, and that's the harpazo. We are expected at any moment. You know, it's gone on several thousand years, but we're still supposed to expect it at any moment. It's my suspicion that that's deliberate on God's part to catch Satan by surprise. And I tend to see Satan as a guy who knows it's coming, but not when. Knows that when it comes, that's going to be a starting gun to a very limited time window. So for 2,000 years, he's lived with a situation where he doesn't know when the jig's up, and he's got his window opportunity. People ask me, do I think the Antichrist is alive today? And I say, absolutely. If you ask me that 100 years ago, I'd say, absolutely. Because it's my presumption that Satan's had to have his guy, whoever it is, in the wings, be ready at any moment. He, in my mind, he's been in shock treatment. Every time somebody accepts Christ and becomes part of the body of Christ, a counter increments by one. And he doesn't know that the counter is now complete. We know that when it's complete, when the fullness of the Gentiles become in, which I think is the term for that completed counter. Well, that means he's been in shock treatment for 2,000 years, but it's pretty clear that that counter is getting complete. There's a point at which he's going to, and he'll have his window of opportunity. So that's what I'm with that prejudice behind me as just a presumption. As I watch the groping in astrobiology for life and so forth. And now that the fact they're almost trying to justify that kind of view, that if that yearning, that orchestration of events and so forth is Satan inspired, it could be that he's grooming us for the ultimate surprise, the ultimate delusion. Because Paul, when he talks about that, makes it very, it's the lie. It's not just deceit. It's a specific deception that he's going, that God's going to allow him to pull off. That's why when I see this embracement in our culture, not just in the Vatican, but also in our scientific community, for these kinds of ideas, we've really popularized in our culture the whole idea of, you know, people from outer space. Some of the entertainments has them evil attacking us. Others have them, they're supposed to try to help us. They have all these conjectures. But they've conditioned the human expectation to consider that part of our reality. That aliens, wherever they are part, would not surprise us that much. And if a spaceship landed on the White House lawn, you know, 40, 50 years ago, it would be, you know, shattering. If it happened next week, it's almost, I'll exaggerate to make my point, but it's almost expected. I think that, yes, it'd be a shock, and yes, it might be more disturbing than we may think, have thought through so far, but I see it coming, because we are to know the wiles of the devil. The fact that they are a form of evil that has our, that we're in jeopardy, requires certainly a spiritual hygiene, point one, but also maybe some knowledgeable hygiene. We were instructed to. On the one hand, I can see a danger of getting preoccupied with them, and certainly a big danger of being fearful of them. I think we need to know enough about them so we shouldn't be fearful of them. I do happen to know that they something about the classification world, because I spent my time in that. If you have a project that has sensitive content, you can classify it top secret or whatever. Fine. If you're more concerned about it, you can go another level. You can make the existence of the contract classified. And they typically call black programs because they're usually for the intelligence community. But the point is, they're desirable to get because your competitors don't know they exist. They're negotiated. They're not very profitable because they're just negotiated cost-plus kinds of things. But it's usually interesting work, and they're highly sought after. Those are many people in the classified world are familiar with what we call compartmented programs. If you've been around a little bit, there's a third level. I was in that world for 30 years, heavily active in that area, and I encountered a situation where I discovered, much to my amazement, there's a third level, and that's where the existence of the organization is classified. And there are court procedures and adjudication procedures for contracts, and where the existence of your contractor and contractee, the contractor, his existence is classified. There are procedures to well-established to do it. I was surprised to get plunged into that world. I also have reason to believe that MJ-12 was real. And Majestic 12, some 20 years ago, some documents floated around that purported that Harry Truman appointed 12 people, six military, six civilians, into a special Majestic 12, was a code name, and they were impaneled to deal with the UFO area. And there were documents on how to handle alien bodies. They were floating around for not very long, when it was quickly discovered that they were a hoax, that the letter that Truman signed had a signature from some other thing. And the 12 people were very well-known, prominent people at that time. But the documents, anyway, for a number of reasons, that was discredited. So most people, there are two kinds of people running around, those that never heard of MJ-12, or those that know that's just a hoax. Except there's one guy that Stanton Friedman was running around, and he spent, 20 years or something, going to libraries. He decided to make a dossier on each of the 12. What most people aren't schooled in is what's called disinformation. Disinformation isn't just wrong information. It's a strategy. And if you're trying to hide MJ-12, one way to do that is to circulate some apparent materials about it, let them get discredited as a hoax, and that forever poisons the well. And from that point on, it's safe. I think MJ-12 is around, obviously under new names. And so is the government involved? Absolutely. And that also is manifested by the fact that they have active classification protection. Where it gets dicey is whether or not there really are laboratories that are benefiting somehow from what they picked up at Roswell. The stories that come out of that imply that there were a number of bodies, one of which was still alive. That's the story. Whatever it was, though, was sealed off very, very quickly and shipped to Wright Pat. And the so-called smoking gun, as they call it, the general that was countermanding the press release was clutching a memo that since has been using digital advanced digital imaging techniques, we've been able to extract some of the. He was holding in his hand a memo of Washington about the bodies and so forth. The Air Force did a terrible job. They contrived cover stories that were so flimsy. I think they were just ineptitude. I don't think they deliberately did it that poorly, but they did it so poorly is it constantly, each time they came out with a cover story, it was even more stupid than before. So clearly Roswell is a huge mystery. The stories that come out of there, and they're all kinds and shapes and sizes, but the real problem is it still is class. You would think that it would be in everyone's interest to disclose what happened there if it's disclosable. What could not be disclosable after 60 years? Is that an issue of national security? You got to be kidding. But very diligent. In fact, Jimmy Carter's one of the guys that campaigned on that he was going to cut through that. And of course, he didn't or couldn't or whatever. I get the impression the British government is a little more accommodating. The Reynolds and Forrest thing apparently has been more released. But the reports there are that they've released are pretty bizarre because it came back. You know, I remember though in June of 52, because I was entering the academy at that time, I remember when Washington National, which it was in those days, and Andrews were shut down for almost a week by the UFO activity. It sent up interceptors and they would disappear. When they landed, they were back again. It was almost a game. It went on for 4 or 5 days, not a whole week, but quite a, I remember that at the time because the papers were full of it. And it was clear that no one knew what was going on. They're trying not to disclose. They couldn't figure out what was going on, but it was pathetic. But the UFO shut down our nation's capital for a week in 19. I remember that because I was there. There was another mystery, by the way, I'll just share with you. Had some discussion. Not long, well, 20 years ago, whenever it was, there used to be a film going around of an alien autopsy. It didn't get very far. It floated around a little bit and was quickly discredited. Although, it wasn't a trivial effort. It was quite an elaborate room, and there was glass windows, people watching. In fact, the tip-off was people watching the other glass windows had surgical masks on, so you wouldn't be recognized. They're outside the environment. But the phone was the right kind of phone for that period. A whole bunch of things about it. Someone had gone through a lot of trouble to try to make it look real. And yet it was still discredited. Never got anywhere. Whoever put the money up obviously didn't recover because it didn't take off. I was with, in fact, it was a friend that was doing the formation flying study at NASA Ames. But I asked him, I said, I don't understand where the budget's coming from. In other words, the guy, whoever did that, spent some money because it wasn't a trivial production. And on the one hand, on the other hand, it was provably phony. And I'm confused because whoever put up the money didn't recover. Where's the money coming from? And the word I got back was cognitive dissonance. Oh, there's another example. Strange example. Arizona. I forget the exact month. I think it was in March of that year. A huge V-shaped thing flies over Arizona, a good part of Arizona. A lot of people saw it. They scrambled aircraft, and people are upset. The next morning, the governor at the time tries to make a joke of it, and people were upset because they wanted answers. And he never got any decent answers. It was June. That was March. So I recall it was June. That event is on the front page of USA Today with a color picture. What puzzled me about it was why? Why wasn't it reported in USA Today in, it was March something or other when it happened within a day or two? Because it was newsworthy. Big turmoil in Arizona. No. The whole thing was covered in the press must have been 3 or 4 months later. I think it was March to June kind of thing. Well, I was really, I searched the paper for some excuse. Why did they run the article then? Was it some new discovery about it? Some new opinion about it? I could not. And at that time, not only was it was on the cover of USA Today. That's where I first picked up on it, but it was also on some newscasts. They talk about the thing that went over Arizona, blah, blah. What they don't tell you is that was back in March, 3 months ago. There wasn't a clear explanation of why. Is it a news issue now? This is June, not March. That puzzled me. But again, it's as if somebody was managing the news. For some reason, they're stirring that up. Because it was 3 months after the fact. I can understand recording it then. You get the feeling that maybe that's, again, it's this cognitive dissonance thing. I think if they are what I think they are, they're dangerous. And I think then, unless somebody has very special training in demonology, exorcisms, that sort of thing, I would steer very clear of it. I advise all my friends to do the same. I've even gone one step further. I had a couple come to me. It happened to be in the context of a church which had a pastor I felt able to handle the situation, where she had been abducted and bone biopsies taken. And she had it all documented. And there are pieces of it that she was just putting together for the first time that evening. And after I talked, they wanted to meet me. So I met with her husband, the pastor. My wife was with me. We went in the study, and this all came out. And what should she do? And I advised her to take all that documentation, put it in a safe deposit box. The only people that need to know about it is her husband and the pastor, and keep it a secret. I said, if the press finds out that you've got a abduction with lesion, they're desperately looking for that, they'll destroy your life. And that's what they did. And I found doubled back with the pastor a year later that she did come to the Lord, and she's spiritually on track, and that was a happy ending. But the point is, I'm guilty of counseling them, and they followed my advice to not disclose it publicly in any way, because I felt it would destroy her and her life, because that would become the people, authors hungry for fodder for a sensational book of some kind. No, I think that pursuing these things is dangerous. They're probably dangerous even for a profession, because if they are what they are, what I think they are, they're demons. In both the connotative and denotative sense. If you're confronted with something like that, I think you rely on the authority of Christ, and you don't allow yourself to get bluffed, and you flee it. You don't embrace it. You don't go searching for it. In my opinion, I think that's unhealthy. There very well may be some circumstances emerge here in our future horizon that may cause me to change that view. But right now, I would try to learn what I can from solid sources, but I wouldn't chase it.